Hello again, everybody in Turdland. This is your humble correspondent, Turd, coming at you with another exciting issue of the TFMR podcast. Today, I thought it would be beneficial if we doubled back to one of our first guests on the podcast, and that's Gonzalo Lira. Many of you probably know who Gonzalo is. He is a economist, a writer. I call him an economist. He's a writer. He's a columnist. He is a internationally known man of mystery and intrigue. He runs. He's the proprietor of LiraSPG.com, which you'll see a link off to the side here. I would encourage you to go check that site out, and I would encourage you, especially in these crazy times in which we live, to strongly consider taking up a subscription there, because the information that Gonzalo provides is simply fantastic, and it really kind of rounds out the information and all the information that's flowing at us, particularly as it pertains to the economy and gold and the European sovereign crisis, if you will. So with that as a background, Gonzalo, thank you very much for taking some time to visit Turdville.
It's a pleasure being on, and it's lovely to talk to you, and let's get started.
And for everybody out there that remembers the first call we had with Gonzalo in this low-tech production facility that I employ, since Gonzalo's down in Chile and I'm out here in the flyover country of the U.S., there's a little bit of a lag time between when I talk and then when Gonzalo talks. And so we're going to try to manage that. At least I'll try to manage that today. So hopefully there won't be too much talking over each other. But anyway, Gonz, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on. But first, in the headlines today, there's this another one of these crazy stories about the $1 trillion worth of old U.S. bearer bonds that are showing up in Europe. I don't know what to make of it, and I don't know if anybody does, but geez, I mean, isn't that, what do you think?
I think it's just some criminals who are getting smart. We were talking just before the taping that offhand, I don't actually know how much actual physical money is in print. I mean, if I had to take a stab at it, I'd say, you know, maybe $1 trillion or $2 trillion worth of actual bills, you know, actual $100 bills and $5 bills and what have you. I don't think it's that much.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, there are approximately $8 trillion worth of treasury bonds that in fact exist, right, somewhere. And so I would venture to say that there are more treasury bonds in print in existence than actual dollar bills or $100 bills or what have you. And so it's not surprising that somebody would get smart, get wise, and decide to, hey, you know, why don't I just, you know, fake some treasury bonds? I mean, a few $100 million more worth of treasury bonds, nobody's going to notice with the kind of debt that the United States government is accruing. You know, what's $100 billion among friends, you know? So I would guess that something like that's going on.
And you know what? And that's really probably the most likely event, that's for sure. But gosh, what a strange story. You couple it with a kind of similar story from 2 or 3 years ago where those Korean guys were caught going over in that same area, I think, going from Italy to Switzerland. And you just think, well, this is just bizarre. But again, you're right. Yeah, it may be just another symptom that the worldwide debt problem is now so overwhelming that why can't you just print a few $100 billion worth of your own counterfeit bonds? I mean, who would notice?
Yeah, and think about it in these terms. If I'm a criminal, okay, I am not a criminal, I am not, you know, I am not telling people to do this, but if I were a criminal, if I were a mob boss or whatever, I would spend, you know, $1 million or $2 million, hell, $5 million to create the sophisticated printing mechanism necessary to falsify treasury bonds. I mean, you know, there are so many bonds out there. There are $8 trillion worth of bonds out there that if I were to spend $5 million of my own money, like out-of-pocket expenses, and print up $100 million worth of treasury bonds, fake treasury bonds, of course, I don't think anybody would really notice. And I think that I could probably get away with it, or some criminal would be able to get away with it. I am not saying that I have done this or would do this. I never would. I just want to be clear. It's actually, you know, if you think about it, if you're going to be completely immoral and just, you know, a thief, this is a pretty good scam, you know? I mean, so why not? But anyway, I think that the issue that's really interesting right now is another scam that's going on is the whole Greek issue. I mean, that's just ridiculous. Those poor Greeks, you know, how can I put it? I want to be clever and use like puns and say, oh, the Greeks are getting it Greek style and stuff like that. And, you know, because that's what's happening to those poor people. They are getting austerity and it is hurting them badly. I mean, they're getting austerity without the benefit of butter. For anybody who saw Last Tango in Paris, you know, I mean, they are really, it's awful for those poor people. And the EU is still squeezing them. And it's just, I don't know what to think of what's going on there. What do you think, TF?
Well, what seems to be so, there's kind of this catch-22 or a paradox in that they are up to their eyeballs in debt in terms of percentage of GDP and all that kind of stuff. So the way for that to then be fixed, apparently, is an issuance of more debt. However, the only way that the EU is going to agree to issue them more debt is if they get their all these austerity measures that are supposedly going to get their economic house in order. But if they do those austerity measures, their economy is only going to further, if it's possible, get worse and collapse even more, which will make them even less able to service their own debt, which means they're going to have to go back to the EU to get even more debt to cover their... I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I'm very anti Keynesianism. You know, I don't go so far as to identify myself with any particular economic strain or ideology, but I'm not a big Keynesian in the sense that, oh, you know, spending is always the way to pull yourself out of any hole. However, it is obvious that if you have a government that is severely contracting and an economy that is generally contracting, and you continue contracting that government and just squeeze it, of course you're going to have a fall in GDP, and of course it's going to be that much more difficult to service the debt that you already have on your books, let alone more debt, because after all, this is more debt that the EU is just putting on top of the previous debt, of the previous bailout. My own sense is that what the Greeks should do is just ditch the euro and go back to the drachma, devalue, and start trying to dig themselves out of the hole that they're in. You know, and I'm sure that a lot of the bonds, I know for a fact that a lot of the bonds are in euros and cannot be converted into the local currency. Mm-hmm. But I think that the Greeks are going to wind up having to pay quite a bit. But I think that at the end of the day, the Greeks have no solution to the problem that they're in. Because even if they squeeze their budgets and do all the austerity measures and go through all the austerity hoops, and they get the money from the EU and the Troika, from the EU, ECB, and IMF, they're going to be in the exact same position in 18 months to 24 months from now. They're going to be with their hand outstretched asking for more money. Just bite the bullet now is my sense.
Yeah.
But of course, for political reasons, it's not going to happen.
Well, and then if that were to happen and Greece were to go back to the drachma and okay, fine. What about Portugal? Don't they have a rather significant series of bond payments that are coming up? And what about Italy? I understand Italy has the economy about two-thirds of the size of Germany. Well,
yes. Yeah. No, I mean, look, at the end of the day, this is what's going to happen. And it's going to be the countries that are going to exit the euro forcibly. I mean, it's either going to be disorderly or orderly. That's the only variable. But these countries are going to exit. And the countries that are going to exit are Greece, Portugal, Spain. I think that they are going to the Troika and everybody in Europe is going to move heaven and earth to keep Italy in the eurozone, because if Italy goes, that's the end of the eurozone. That's a complete continent-wide meltdown. So they're going to do everything they can to salvage Italy. And after all, the Italian situation is not that bad. They have a fragile financial system, but they're making their nut, if you will, insofar as covering their budgets and so forth. They have a debt overhang, but they're not digging themselves deeper into the hole the way Greece is, the way Portugal is, the way Spain is. So Italy can be saved, but I don't think that Portugal or Greece can be saved. And I think that the interesting issue is Ireland. Now, I don't mean any disrespect to the good people of Ireland. I've been to Ireland several times. It's a lovely country, lovely people. But the Irish have this weird thing of, you know, almost a masochistic streak that once they collectively decide to do something, no matter how stupid, they just go through it. They have collectively decided that they are going to pay their debts, even though they didn't accrue these debts, because after all, these are the debts accrued by Ireland's financial system, the big banks of Ireland, which the government of Brian Cowan foolishly guaranteed, and now, of course, they're paying for it. They're paying for it in spades. Now, I think that the Irish, masochists as they are, they are going to pay every last penny of their euro debts. And so I would venture to say that the best bet insofar as sovereign debts are concerned is the Irish debt. Irish debt is yielding something like 8.2%. It was up there at 15% at one point, 16% even. I don't mind telling you, I was lucky enough to catch that ride at around 13 yielding. And it's a great investment because these poor people, I repeat, I have been to Ireland, and they are lovely people, but they are masochists. They are going to pay for a debt that they did not accrue, okay? And they are going to sacrifice their economy in order to get out of this hole that they're in. And so for bondholders, Ireland is the best bet. For bondholders, you know, if I were holding Greek bonds or Portuguese bonds, I'd be scared out of my mind. Well, depending on what price I purchased them, of course. But Irish bonds, that is a safe bet as far as I'm concerned.
And as masochistic as it sounds, like you said, they are at least kind of doing what we want everyone to do. I mean, yes, maybe they're not responsible for their financial institutions' debts, but at least they're not just chucking it. And
well, yeah, but this is, see, Turd, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but see, that's the point of the Irish. See, they are the only country, okay, that did not deserve this. And yet they are the only one country that is paying, okay? See, at least, you know, the Greeks, they enjoyed their boom time, right? I mean, they spent the money, and so did the Portuguese, and so did the Spanish. But the Irish are paying the banksters' money, okay? Not their own spending spree. And that's why I find it just so incredibly ironic, because you're right, we should pay up all our debts, but of course we should pay our debts. I mean, if you go into debt, you know, if you buy, you know, some giant 100-inch plasma screen TV for $50,000, right, and then can't pay it, well, you should be the one to suffer, right? But imagine, you know, I mean, it would be wrong for you to chuck that debt for a $50,000 100-inch plasma screen TV, but what about paying off the debt of your local savings and loan? Nobody would say that you are responsible for that. But that is, in essence, what the Irish are doing. They are paying for their banking system, which is pretty funny. But going back to the Greek situation, I think that the Greek situation, they have a big payment that they have coming up here. I keep forgetting if it's March 20th or March 23rd. It doesn't really matter. The point is they need to cover that debt. It's like a $7 billion euro hole. And if they don't cover it, I think that that's going to be curtains. So we'll see if they cover it or they don't.
Well, and that's the question. And in fact, I thought it was more like 14 plus some additional change on top of that. But regardless, that seems to be the moment of truth. I guess I have a two-pronged question for you. I think I understand the differences between the European banking system and, say, our American banking system. But I don't want – and again, I don't want to put you on the spot and make you answer something that maybe that you're not that familiar with. I don't know. But to me, as I understand it, where American banks typically make their own loans or have their own portfolios, European banks are leveraged to each other in that almost an incestuous relationship where – one bank's assets is somebody else's collateral, and then they use that again as collateral with another bank. And so they're all tied financially to each other. And so if one or two banks are undercapitalized due to defaults on Greek or other sovereign debt, it really could not only negatively impact the whole European financial system, it could almost bring the whole thing down. I mean, is that accurate?
Well, you're right about the European system, but it's also the same with the American system. Because, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the debts were transformed into mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities, and what have you. And those were purchased by other agents in the financial industry in the United States. So you could say, in that sense, that everybody owes everybody else the money.
Yep.
And the same with Europe. And sure, you can have like a zipper effect that, you know, one goes down and they all go down. And I think that that's the issue that everybody's so afraid of in Europe, because nobody's really, really clear as to what exposure is going on, because everybody lies about their book, mm-hmm. right? Everybody always says, you know, I mean, how often do you hear a guy honestly say, you know, I bought, you know, Groupon stock and I took a shellacking? How many people actually say that? Nobody says that. They always say, oh yeah, I shorted Groupon, I made a ton of money. Or, you know, everybody lies. And of course, the European banks in particular have a great incentive to be not necessarily lying, but fudging their numbers so that they don't look that bad, so that they don't get the scrutiny of the ECB and the local authorities, right? But they're all, you know, teetering, and everybody has a sense of that. And so nobody really knows what's going to happen once Greece goes. Now, Greece, of course, this has been a long time coming. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that on March 20th or 23rd, you know, Greece defaults and, you know, all hell breaks loose. These banks have had, what, close to 22 months since the first spark back in 2010. It was April 2010 when the Greek situation reared its ugly head for the first time. So they've had 21 months or so to get their house in order. Everybody knows what's going on with Greece. Everybody knows that they're, you know, teetering on the edge of default. If they finally do default and a bank goes under because of it, well, first of all, you want to take the board of directors of that bank and just put them up against the wall and shoot them, because they're just too stupid, right? Because they saw it coming. It's not like an asteroid that fell out of the clear blue sky and just landed on your head. Uh-uh. This is like a train that started coming about 10 miles away, and you're standing on the track, and you saw it coming 10 miles away, and then 5 miles away, and you need a telescope, of course, to see it, because that's how far away this sucker is. And finally, you know, it's 100 yards away from you, and you're still on the tracks, and you don't get off the tracks. Well, then you deserve to be run over, frankly, you know? That's my sense about the whole Greek situation. Now, yeah, I mean, honestly, right? So I think that anybody who really takes a beating over the Greek situation is an idiot and had it coming.
Gonzalo, you're killing me. I'm sitting here. Here I am in the police state of America. You're sitting down there in Chile, right?
Right.
And now, not only have you turned on the Secret Service and the Treasury Department to come after me, as we've talked about what a great scam it is to print fake treasuries, Now we're going to take European bank boards of directors and shoot them. Just sitting here laughing to myself. Anyway,
that's a great thing about being in Chile. You know, I can't be extradited.
Yeah, no, you're in great shape down there. All right, so then let me.
By the way, sorry, TF. Just so that our listeners know that I'm going to assume that when I hear the whoop, whoop, whoop of the black helicopters, you know, in the background, that's they're coming for you. And if the broadcast is suddenly interrupted, it's because of the men in black coming to get you, right?
If this podcast never gets posted, okay. Then you'll know. Yeah. Okay. I'll just be –
Well, actually, no, because I am actually making my own recording. So if you do get taken away by the black helicopters, I will, you know, post this up so that everybody can hear, you know, how you got – rendered.
Awesome. That could be really good for your site too, because I would imagine if you posted it there, people would have to subscribe. This could be a really positive economic event for you.
Hey, you know, you're so right. Hang on. Let me just call Homeland Security so they'll go and get you. And yeah, because that would be great. That would be really, man, you're a really smart guy. You know, yeah. Hang on. Homeland Security. Yeah. I'm here about this guy, Turt Ferguson. You got to go and shut him down. You know, he's talking trash about the Treasury Department and so on. I'm sorry. I'm being an idiot.
That's what it would be. It'd be, hello, this is Chaz Napolitano. Please leave a message after the tone. All right. Back to Greece. Tell me if you think I'm seeing this right, because of course I have to look at it as how can this impact precious metals and the long-term goals of holding them. So tell me if you think this little theory is correct. And bear with me because this can take me a second to lay this one out. Greece, one way or the other, Greece either defaults or gets a bunch of cash printed to, I guess, cover all of their debt issues. One way or another, though, they're going to have an issue, and then it's going to roll to Portugal. So Jim Sinclair pointed out a couple of weeks ago that where he sees the big event is whether ISDA, the International, what is it, Swaps and Derivatives Association, whatever they are, but they're the ones that would have to define whether a technical default took place. And so they were kicking around whether, you know, a 50% haircut or a 30% haircut would be a default. I tell you what, you can get into the semantics, but if you don't make your payments come March 20th, that's definitely, no ifs, ands, or buts about it, that's a default. If a default is declared, then as Jim told us, he thinks up to 97% of the credit default swaps on Greek debt have been issued by the big five U.S. banks, be it Goldman and Morgan Stanley and J.P. Morgan and the like. So if a default is declared, the credit default swaps have to pay off. Well, hey, where would those banks get their money to pay off? They don't have it themselves, so that it's coming to them through the Fed. So there's one way that the Fed funnels money into Europe is through Goldman Sachs and through J.P. Morgan, just like how the Fed in 2008 funneled money to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan through AIG. So scenario one, there's a default, money flows into Europe. Scenario two, there's a default, but ISDA does not declare it a default. And so all of a sudden, no one wants to own sovereign debt. All of that sovereign debt takes this big haircut. All these European bank balance sheets suddenly are untenable. And so now all of a sudden the IMF has to come in, or the ECB through the Fed, whomever, or the IMF through the Fed has to come in and float a bunch of cash. Either way, I just don't see how come March, this isn't an even increasing amount of quantitative easing, printing of money to try to kick the can and keep everybody afloat. Obviously, gold positive. Do you agree?
I don't think this is going to really affect gold one way or the other, because I disagree with your assumption. Your base assumption is, which I would agree with in normal times, but these aren't normal times. Your base assumption is that people are going to honor their contracts. That insofar as credit default swaps, they will be honored if a bond or a sovereign nation defaults, the CDS written on that bond will be honored. But that's the thing. I don't think that the CDSs are going to be triggered. I think that they're going to come up with some excuse not to trigger them. At the end of the day, I think that CDSs were a big financial masturbation, if you get right down to it. And sorry for being so vulgar. But, well, everybody knows that I'm a vulgar bastard anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But my serious point is that CDSs are not going to be triggered come hell or high water, because of the exposure that you're talking about. It's such a huge amount of exposure that they will not allow it to be triggered, and they will come up with some sort of subterfuge one way or the other to not trigger them, to have the CDSs remain intact, and to have the bonds be nominally not in default, but practically in default. Mm-hmm. And it'll be reflected in the price of the bond. Look, see, you can have a bond worth zero that has not technically defaulted because it's been making all of its payments, right?
Right.
I think that that's ultimately what's going to wind up happening somehow, one way or the other. I don't quite know what mechanism they will use to make this happen, but it will happen because the cost of allowing an outright default of Greek, Portuguese, Spanish debt is so high on not just the American banks, but also the European banks, on everybody, on the entire financial system, that it's just, they're just not going to be triggered, and it's not going to happen. I think that it's and so that's why I'm disagreeing with your basic assumption that people will honor contracts, because the thing that I am realizing is that in this financial crisis, the laws and all contracts are being dispensed with in order to save the system.
Right.
Now, of course, my mentality is, if you have a system and you want to keep the system in the long run, you have to enforce those rules that you have, you know, agreed upon, and especially for enforce contracts, because that's the whole point of a government, is to enforce contracts between market participants, right?
Maintain the rule of law.
Exactly. So if you suspend that contractual obligation for the sake of perpetuating the system, the system in itself becomes corrupted. It's better to let the players within the system collapse, but let the system remain in place. Because I don't have a problem with the system as it was prior to 2000. Just for the sake of argument, let's put up a near-term line and just say that the system in 2000 was okay generally. It had flaws here and there, what have you, and Glass-Steagall being rescinded and all the rest of it. But overall, it sort of worked. But the point is, ever since we had the crisis, rather than applying the rules and letting those who failed, they've been trying to save the market participants because they have been confusing the market participants with the actual system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, see, Goldman Sachs is not the system. JP Morgan is not the system. They are merely players within the system because a system is a framework. Now, if you start messing with that framework in order to save the market participants, you are creating a corrupt system. A corrupt system that will not long survive, and we're seeing it now. And we're seeing it now since 2008. What should have happened in 2008 is what they did in Iceland. In Iceland, they perpetuated the system and let all the players go broke, right? All the banks, Krapting, and all the rest of them, they all went broke. You know, nobody got saved. Everybody got screwed. Everybody who deserved to get screwed got screwed. And they had two miserable years, right? It just got announced that Iceland is now back in business. They have investment-grade bonds, and everybody's happy, and Iceland is taking off again. But the thing is, see, the market participants today are completely different from the ones in 2008 who brought down the Icelandic financial system, financial sector, rather. The Icelanders followed the rule of law. They let the guys go broke who go bankrupt who deserve to go bankrupt. They didn't save anybody. They saved their system, their framework, their law-abiding financial system. And sure, they went through 2 years of hell, but now they're back. That's what should have happened in 2008 in the United States and in Europe. It didn't happen. I personally was all in favor of letting Lehman go bankrupt, and I was in favor of letting the whole system go down, letting all the market participants, rather, go down in order to save the system. Mm-hmm. Because the system itself is not wrong, was not a bad system. But now with all this too big to fail stuff and all this bending of the law in order to save specific participants, you have created a corrupt system. Look at MF Global. MF Global, they were a bunch of thieves, right? Are any of those participants going to jail? No, they are not. They're doing this, you know, very la-di-da kind of bankruptcy, and 36,000 clients are getting screwed out of their money. Their money has been stolen. Right, and that is an example of how the system has been corrupted, because the system was – the framework of it, from my point of view, was a valid framework that worked. But you have to apply the laws for the framework to work, and the people in charge of applying the laws have not been doing so. I'm sorry. This is a long-winded way of answering your question, but I hope I
covered. You did. And my thought was, I just keep hearing W in my mind telling us that I had to ignore the free market to save the free market. That kind of sounds more like Clinton. Sorry.
Got to burn the village to save it.
That's exactly right. Getting back, though, and just one last thing. If that is the case, the bonds are still marked down. The bonds are still marked. They receive a mark at 30 or at 50, which changes the capitalization of all of these banks that are all intertwined. It's going to take a lot of new cash to try to bring them back up to the – right? So there's cash, and that's cash got to come from somewhere. The ECB can't print it. So from the IMF through the – from the U.S. through the IMF, I don't – one way or the other, it's another massive quantitative easing event, I guess is what my ultimate point is.
Well, my thinking is I'm not too clear how the whole Greek European situation is going to affect a potential collapse in the currency, in the American currency, in the dollar. Certainly, gold is seeing new highs against the euro, right? Mm-hmm. But and it will continue to see those highs as Greek, you know, either defaults or quasi defaults and exits the eurozone, and Portugal and Spain does the same. Sure, because the euro is going to go down, of course. And my expectation at Lira SPG, we've discussed this in quite a great deal of detail, is my expectation is that the euro will drop all the way to about 1 euro to 60 cents American, you know, roughly half of what it is today. Because, yeah, look, when Ireland nearly got popped back in December 2010, the euro fell from 144 to 122 in like the space of 3 weeks. I mean, it was a really – people have sort of like forgotten that little dip, but that was a hairy ride. I remember it very clearly. We got to keep in mind that if there is an actual exit of one of the countries, even a small one like Greece, because after all, Greece represents less than 2% of the total GDP of the eurozone. Okay, it is a small country. It is a small piece of the whole European puzzle. Even if that country exits, you know, you could expect to see an easily a drop from, what is it, 130 to, I don't know, 110? No, without breaking a sweat. So seeing it reach, you know, 60 cents American to the euro, that's totally within the realms of the possible if one of the big countries like Spain exits. But anyway, my concern at this point is not really the European situation, because like I said, the European situation is like a train wreck that you've been watching come at you for about 10 miles now, okay? It's not a big surprise. The issue that has me really concerned is Iran, because the Israelis want a war with Iran, okay? And they are doing everything in their power to create this war. I tend to believe that the quote-unquote attacks that have happened in Thailand and India, I believe that they're manufactured. I don't believe for a second that they are actually Iranian attacks, because the Iranians have no upside to staging terrorist attacks in those two countries, because both India and Thailand represent foreign trade to the Iranians. They are not going to antagonize India especially by, you know, staging some, you know, crazed terrorist and pointless terrorist attack, because, you know, bombing some diplomat, that's, you know. And here's another thing that we have to face that I think the media in the West does not want to face or doesn't understand, or maybe they're in the pockets of the leadership that insists that we have to go to war with Iran. But Iran has not staged a terrorist attack in the West. I mean, name one terrorist attack that they've committed in the last 20 years. They haven't.
I don't want to interrupt your line of reasoning. Some would say that they operate through proxies, like Hezbollah.
Mm. Yeah, but who does Hezbollah attack? No. You know, the border of Lebanon and Israel, okay? Yeah. That is not the world. That is not a global terrorist network, okay? And everybody knows that Hezbollah has been funded and supported by the Iranians, as Syria has supported different players in Lebanon and all the rest of it. Nobody's doubting that. But the issue is, you know, has Iran like sent, you know, some bomb, you know, into Washington, D.C. to blow up some diplomat or ambassador? Well, they had this crazy plot, but it was just so foolish and ridiculous that it sounds a lot like, you know, those poor patsies that are used by the FBI who are set up to take a fall, and when they finally catch them, quote unquote, you know, oh, it's like this big terror plot was revealed and it turned out to be like a manufactured plot. I just don't buy it. I'm sorry if
no,
I'm...
No, I would just give you one other aside, and not necessarily devil's advocate, but...
Gosh, go ahead.
Now, again, to the extent that this is all to be believed, but a lot of, or the main manufacturer of IEDs in Iraq when they were wiping out 1,000-plus U.S. servicemen every year from 05 to 08, those were all supposedly manufactured and shipped in from Iran. Just saying.
Well, yeah, but that the whole point of an IED It's an improvised explosive device, and apparently it was created from the stuff that was just lying around, yeah, of the ordnance that was left there. And here's another issue. The majority of the population in Iraq is Shiite. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they follow the religious leadership in Iran because the religious leadership in Iran is Shiite. Okay, so it's like you know, saying that, just for the sake of argument, suppose the following. Suppose, like, you know, the Germans, Lutherans, invaded Italy, right? Mm-hmm. And they invaded Italy, and, you know, like, the Italians started, you know, putting bombs against the Germans or what have you, right? Improvised explosive devices, right? And the Germans said, oh, it's the Vatican is behind it all because, you know, the Italians are all Catholics and the Vatican, well, they're the leaders of the Catholics, so it's the Vatican that is behind all of this. It doesn't make any sense, okay? I am very leery of this war that's going on with Iran. I don't I think it's pointless to fight it because it's going to happen because so many people want this war to happen. I think it's immoral. I think that a lot of people are going to get killed. I think the United States is going to get dragged into it foolishly. And I think a lot of American soldiers are going to get killed. And that the American people don't, you know, acquiesce to this new war, this war of aggression that is not even started by the United States but is going to be started by Israel, which is going to drag the United States into it. And the American people are just going to acquiesce to it. Well, I don't know what to say, you know.
What? I mean, let me just ask you this. And again, you've given us a lot of time, and so I probably ought to kind of move toward conclusion. But because I agree with you. The writing appears to be on the proverbial wall. What is the economic implication? You can obviously say, well, yes, oil, you know, will go up, and that will slow down the economy and the global economy, and blah blah blah. But beyond that, is it a step towards a global debt reset? Is there any of that, do you think, in the calculus of why this is going to take place?
No, this is at Lyra SPG, we have a whole scenario devoted to precisely a war between Israel and Iran and the effects of that war. And I've been planning for it since, I don't know, May, June of last year. And what to do and what's going to happen. This is, in a nutshell, this is what's going to happen. See, a war breaks out, right? Now, the Strait of Hormuz, right in front of Iran, right? About a fifth of the world's oil passes there every day. That strait is going to become a war zone, okay? Now, even if the oil is not really interrupted, even for the sake of argument that it is not interrupted at all, the perception, and at the end of the day, in markets, perceptions are what matter, not reality. The perception is going to be that oil is going to be interrupted at some point because of this war. And that's going to mean that oil is going to go up drastically in price. And we are going to have the exact same thing that happened in 1979. In January of 1979, well, let me phrase that, in December of 1978, 1 month before the Iranian Revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran and interrupted Iranian oil to the United States because of the chaos of that civil war, inflation in the United States was something like 5.5%. Within a year, it was in the double digits. And it was pushing up to 15%. And that's when Paul Volcker raised his rates in the famous Saturday Night Massacre and raised them up to, 23%?
Something like that.
Yes. And see, if there is an oil shock in Iran due to a war with Iran, sure, the United States is not importing any oil from Iran, but Europe is. And ironically, the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, Spain, and Italy, are the main recipients of Iranian oil. They account for roughly about, I think it's about 13% of their oil. I forget the numbers. I have it in the analysis at the SPG site. But roughly 13% of their oil comes from Iran. If they get shut out of that oil, it's going to be a huge hit to those economies. The rise in the price of oil to those countries, it's going to be devastating. It's going to be devastating on an inflationary basis. And gold is definitely going to go up because of it. And it's going to be really, really ugly. Now, of course, any kind of a debt reset or anything like that, you know, you're basically going to have inflation having its way with debt. Okay? Of course, anybody who's sitting on top of precious metals is going to be looking really, really clever. And the more you think that war is going to take place, the better bet would be precious metals, especially silver. Because I would think that silver would rise, because it's a more volatile precious metal, it would rise more precipitously than gold in a percentage basis because of any kind of oil shock. I think that that's what's going to happen. And I think that the global economy is going to be suffer much worse today than in 1979, because in 1979, or rather in December of 78, just before the oil shock, the world economy was in much, much better shape than the global economy is today. The banking sector in the United States, in Europe, was solid, okay? People think, oh, but the Latin American debt crisis. Yeah, but the Latin American debt crisis happened after the oil shock and was a product of the oil shock of 79. In December of 78, things were looking hunky-dory. Low inflation, unemployment was pretty low, things were going pretty good. After January of 79, after the oil shock of the Iranian Revolution, things went south very, very quickly. Now, the economy we have today is in dreadful shape. Now, over at ShadowStats, John Williams' site, with what he believes are the true numbers insofar as inflation and unemployment are concerned, you know, he's talking about inflation up there, I mean, unemployment rather up there at around 11% as it was counted in 1980. And he's talking about inflation that is close to double digits, even though the official rate is half of what he's saying. I tend to believe John Williams more because he gives you every single scrap of data and shows you exactly how he's arriving at his numbers. And so it's to me, it seems more credible than the black magic box that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has to generate its unemployment figures. But be that as it may, nobody really questions the fact that the world economies are in much weaker shape today than the global economy was in 1978 before the oil shock. If we have a similar oil shock, it's going to hurt a lot worse, and the dollar inflation is going to be a lot more drastic. And since the Fed recognizes that it cannot raise rates, you're going to have galloping inflation that is just going to get out of control. Here's another thing that I've noticed about the Federal Reserve, by the way, and the ECB. Well, not so much the ECB, but much more the Federal Reserve, is that they have a certain arrogance about inflation. They think that they can stop it on a dime, that it's just, you know, oh, we just raise rates, boom, it's done. They have actually forgotten that it took Paul Volcker 36 months to rein in inflation. And during those 36 months, he had the Fed funds rate at an average of 4.5 percentage points above the rate of inflation. And it still took him 36 months to rein in inflation, okay? I mean, think about that. I'm talking August of 79 all the way to August of 83. That's how long it took him to rein in inflation and have it more or less controllable, okay? The Fed today seems to think, oh, we can control inflation because, of course, every general fights the last war. Ben Bernanke and the Federal Reserve today are so terrified of a lack of liquidity, of a credit crunch a la 2008, which is the last crisis that they remember, that they're not thinking about the previous crisis, which was 79. They are going to get caught with their pants down, and they're not going to be able to control inflation. They're going to go for half measures, and so inflation is going to run riot if there is a war with Iran, because a war with Iran inevitably will interrupt the oil production, not just of Iran, but of the other neighboring Gulf states. And that's why I'm really concerned about that.
Yeah, and even without war, though I agree with you, it's coming. The unlimited quantitative easing inevitably induces a cost push inflation, which nobody seems to understand. Sure. And the Fed, you mentioned Volcker, does not have that tool in their back pocket. There's no way that we can run that type of index. That's what ZERP is all about. That's why they're keeping interest rates so low at $554 billion was the debt service on the U.S. debt in fiscal 2011. And that's at an average maturity and yield of both around 4 years and 4%. If you were to triple that debt service, the Ponzi unravels that much faster. Let me just ask you one last question, because you mentioned I had no idea. it's an interesting coincidence, and I, for one, just don't believe in coincidence anymore. Interesting coincidence that you point out that the main, again, pigs, for lack of a better term, the main pig economies, Greece and Italy and Portugal and Spain, their primary oil supply comes from Iran.
Not their primary oil, but a big chunk. I mean, 13% is
a big chunk.
Is a big chunk, yeah. But their primary, I do believe, might be Russia.
And Italy gets a lot from Libya.
Right.
Nonetheless, interesting how those two potential events, a Greek default, a Portuguese default, a Spanish default, whatever, and their exit from the euro would be timed with an Iranian conflict?
Well, you're saying basically that, you know, the pigs, are in a deep hole, you know, because of their over-indebtedness, and at the same time, they could get slammed with a war with Iran. And you're saying that maybe that's a coincidence, but my own sense is that, you know, some countries are just born unlucky, I guess. I don't know, man. I don't really put much stock in terms of coincidence on that level. What I do, because, I mean, they're causally from completely different directions. And also, Iranian oil goes to other countries in Europe. The pigs are going to get hurt, but other countries are also going to get tapped out. I mean, France and Germany, I do believe, get some of their oil, not much, from Iran, and so does Turkey, of course. And so I think that, you know, it's coincidental. It's not really important. But the point, though, is that an Iranian oil shock would hurt those countries and really push them over the edge. Now, look, I've noticed that this whole Iran thing is becoming – I personally am fascinated by this Iranian hysteria because it seems to me that a lot of it comes from guilt in the United States, especially in among the senior policy people, because they recognize that Iran may or may not be developing nuclear weapons. I think that they probably are. I mean, if I were an Iranian leader, I'd be hell-bent for leather on getting myself a nuke for simple survival purposes. Because, I mean, if I have the largest military in the world surrounding me on both my borders, and I have the Secretary of State of that country, Hillary Clinton, who has said repeatedly that, you know, if Iran moves an inch, we're going to wipe them off the face of the earth, as she said during her campaign against Barack Obama. If you have this constant attack against me, I'm speaking from the point of view of the Iranians. If you have the United States and Europe threatening to make it impossible for me to sell my only resource in order to gain some foreign currency and help my people establish a better life for themselves, I would feel justified in getting a nuclear weapon. Everybody always talks about, oh, the Iranians are being so aggressive. But from the point of view of the Iranians, they are being completely defensive, and they are showing remarkable patience and self-control, because the provocations of the West have been egregious, and some of the sins that the West has committed against Iran are just unforgivable. The 1952 coup, the shooting down of the Iran Air 655 back in, what was it, 86, and they gave the guys who did that war crime, they gave them medals when they came back. I mean, that's just a slap in the face. You know, all sorts of stuff that is just ridiculous. I mean, I remember reading, you know, a few years ago that they expelled some security guards from the New York diplomatic diplomatic contingent, you know, some security guys, because you know what they were doing? They were like videotaping the Statue of Liberty and like some Puerto Rican day parade, Cinco de Mayo or whatever, and you know, which is a completely normal thing, but they were accused of like videotaping in order to plan a terrorist attack. Stupid. But my point is, from the point of view of the Iranians, there has been so much provocation that I'm surprised that they really haven't gone out there and done a lot of real terrorism, not this made-up terrorism that they keep insisting that the Iranians are behind, but that doesn't pass the smell test, on the one hand. And on the other hand, if I were an Iranian leader, I'd be all in favor of getting a nuclear weapon. And frankly, I don't think, looking at this coolly and calmly, I don't think a nuclear Iran is particularly dangerous. I mean, you have to look at, for instance, the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and Pakistan is a lot more unstable than the Iranians. The Iranians have not had a forcible change of government in 30 years, whereas Pakistan has a forcible change of government every other day. You know, those guys really are unstable, right? And of course, the U.S. operations in Afghanistan and the borders with Pakistan are not helping matters much, but that's another question, another issue. The point is, I don't think that a nuclear Iran is particularly a problem. And in point of fact, I would tend to think that it would be, it might be beneficial, because then you'd have two nuclear powers, Israel and Iran, and they would balance each other out. But the fact that Israel, and especially Saudi Arabia, people don't mention this very much, but the Saudis in particular really wanted to stabilize the Shia regime in Iran because they're afraid of them. Because the Shia regime in Iran has much more legitimacy historically and religiously than the Saudi royal family. The Saudi royal family is really an invention. They didn't exist 120 years ago. They're new. They were created in order to exploit the oil that was in Saudi Arabia. They were just a bunch of goat herders and you know, Bedouins. They were nobodies. But the fact of the matter is they were sitting on that land, and the British Aramco company, you know, set them up as the Royal House of Saud and created Saudi Arabia, but it's a historical fiction. And the Royal House of Saud is terrified of the Iranian theocracy, because it is a theocracy. But the point is that theocracy in particular has much more popular legitimacy than the House of Saud. The Saudis in particular have been very much in favor of regime change in Iran. But that, of course, passes sort of like under the radar because most people don't know enough about Saudi history and Iranian history and the tensions between the Shia and the Sunni that they just don't quite understand it. So they figure, oh, it's, you know, it's just hatred of Israel. But it's much more complicated than that. And, well, be that as it may, I think that there's going to be a war. I think that it's going to spark an oil crisis that's going to hit inflation. I think that inflation is going to rise precipitously and the Federal Reserve will not be able to deal with it. I think that people who are sitting on top of gold and silver in particular are going to do extremely well. And I think that at the end of the day, it's going to be a lot of people killed and a lot of nations ruined for not much. But that's my opinion.
Guns, you're the man. I tell you what, I, you know, we have this technological issue when I talk to you, and so I think you probably noticed, I've just let you just roll. This is like being in a lecture hall. It's fantastic, and I know that all of the turdites in Turdville greatly appreciated listening to you, and anybody that listens can tell that you're plugged in. You keep track of a lot of stuff, and you're able to war game it in a sense, and think about how one thing might impact another, which might impact another, and then forecast and plan for it. And that's all part of what makes the work that you do at Lyra SPG so terrific. And I think anybody that's been listening to this should be very interested in checking out that site. And picking up a subscription because you tie things together very well, and it certainly all makes sense. And as we all plan for what certainly is going to be a real crazy 2012,
you know, that's what I said. You know, a couple of years ago, I was like thinking about a lot of different things and what could happen in 2012, sort of like, you know, projecting myself into the future. And, you know, there's this whole Mayan thing that the world is going to end in 2012. And I think that's just a bunch of baloney, frankly. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of funny that ironically, a whole host of issues are coming to head in 2012, the European situation, the U.S. debt situation, the Middle Eastern situation. And on top of that, we haven't even talked about China. China is looking precarious at best, you know, and so, you know, it's looking like 2012 is going to be like a righteously screwed up year. So bring it on, baby.
and you're right, no doubt about it. And so I would, again, I encourage everybody to check out Gonzalo's Blogspot site, which I link to a lot that has free content. But gosh, if you want to get more into it, take a look at lirasspg.com, lirasspg.com, and get yourself a subscription, and I think you'll be well served for it. Gonzalo, thank you very much for your generous time that you've given everyone, and hopefully we can we'll have to talk again sometime soon.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure, TF, and I will talk to you soon. And to all the Turdites out there, happy trading.
Rock on, Garth.
Party on, Wayne.